Possible in part by a grant from Birkenstock Concepts by Heel to Toe in downtown Urbana. For over 25 years, offering all sizes and widths of Birkenstocks, from clogs and sandals to work, dress, and sport shoes. Birkenstock Concepts offers repair and modification services and a certified podorthist and orthotist on staff. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Verde Gallery, featuring Dia de los Muertos, a celebration of art, music, words, and dance. Starts October 25th and runs through December 4th. Verde Gallery, a fine art gallery, cafe, and newsroom at 17 East Taylor, downtown Champaign. On the web at www.verdant-systems.com. Be inspired.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us today. When young people in foster care leave the system at the age of 18, are they prepared for living on their own? What's it like to be 18 years old and on your own? Our guest this afternoon is a journalist who got to know some kids who, as they say, aged out of the foster care system. Martha Shirk is our guest. Together with Gary Stengler, she is co-author of On Their Own, What Happens to Kids When They Age Out of the Foster Care System. The book contains in-depth profiles of 10 young people from diverse backgrounds, from big and small cities, Hispanics, whites, African Americans. Listeners, you're invited to join the discussion with questions and comments. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, use the toll-free number if the call would be long distance. The toll-free number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Martha Shirk spent 23 years as a reporter for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, where she wrote extensively about children's issues. Shirk and Stengler's book, On Their Own, What Happens to Kids When They Age Out of the Foster Care System, is published by Westview, a division of Perseus. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Martha Shirk, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Well, thanks for taking the time to discuss this.
Sure, sure. I thought what we would do is we would start with a little bit of an overview, then, as sort of what you do in the book, a little bit of an overview, go to the stories of some of these young people, and then come back to the overall themes and what we can do to make the situation better.
Sounds like a good plan.
Okay. Well, to begin with, you know, the idea of being 18 years old and on your own is something that is kind of foreign to me. I can only imagine it because it never happened to me. What are the challenges 18-year-olds are likely to face when they're leaving the foster care system?
Well, it's a very foreign concept to most of us because the fact is that most American families don't push their children out the door at the age of 18 and say, okay, you're on your own. But that is what the foster care system has historically done. Very few people have even been aware of that until recently. If you ask the typical person on the street, what do you think happens to foster kids when they turn 18? They'd either say, well, gee, I don't know, I never thought about it, or they're most likely to answer, well, they probably just stay on with the foster family that they were living with. That's very unusual, untrue in most cases, and the fact is that many 18-year-olds leave foster care with absolutely no idea of where they're going to live the next night, let alone for the next year. And you can imagine, if you're 18, what the challenges are of figuring out how to make your way in the world. I mean, especially if you haven't yet finished high school, which is true of half of all children leaving foster care. If you've had no work experience, which is true of most of them because they have moved frequently and have been unable to put down roots in a particular community. Most of them have lagged behind academically because of their frequent moves. I think the most recent research in Illinois shows that most of the 17-year-olds getting ready to age out read at the seventh grade level. They are twice as likely as other children to have been suspended from school, four times as likely to have been expelled. And they're also carrying a lot of emotional baggage because they have been removed from their families, which is a very traumatic event. No matter what has happened in the home, what the conditions are, the actual removal is traumatic. And then what has happened to them in foster care over the next few years is also trauma piled upon trauma. The typical child who is in foster care for 4 years or more nationally moves 37 times. So they emerge at 18 with no sense of place in the world, no sense of stability, a background of almost total chaos.
Yeah, that is amazing. For children who stay in foster care 4 years or more, the median number of placements is 37.
Yeah, I have checked that figure over and over again because I find it so unbelievable. But that's what the national data show. In some places, of course, it's better than that, and some individual foster children are lucky enough to land in a foster family that meets their needs and that is willing to deal with their teenage behaviors and gives them a home for the bulk of their adolescence. But that's not the typical profile.
Yeah. Well, if you have so many placements, your life is, you're adrift. Instability, the word screams to me, instability. What does that instability in placements mean? Maybe you could give us some examples here for the young person who leaves foster care at 18.
Well, one of the young men I profile in the book is, he's now 19, and his name's Alfonso Torres. He was born in Miami, and his story is actually fairly typical for children born in the 80s and entering foster care in the 80s. His mother was a crack user, and he was actually born affected by crack, though he shows no lasting effects, which is also thankfully typical. But he went into foster care as a baby, managed to go home with his father eventually. His father at that point was a stable parent. The mother came back into his life, though, and the household became less stable. He was removed again at the age of five, spent two more years in foster care, this time in a Spanish-speaking household when he only spoke English. So you can just try to imagine for a five-year-old child what it's like not to be able to speak to your caregivers or understand what they're telling you. He went home for a few more years. By now, his father had a girlfriend, and the household was in tremendous turmoil, and he was the scapegoat for every problem in the household. At the age of 10, he called the police himself to report that he was being beaten, and he was removed from the household, never lived with his family again. Now, you know, many of us hearing this story think, well, he was better off without this family. It was a terrible family. But the fact is that he loved his father, and he never stopped wanting to go home to his father. He called him whenever he got near a payphone. His heart was broken by the experience. And if you think about what might have been able to happen had resources been put towards making that father a better father, ameliorating the stress in the household, instead of keeping Alfonso in foster care for 8 years, through the very formative teenage years. I mean, there might have been a better outcome. The fact is that since he aged out of care, Alfonso has been homeless. He's a terrific charmer. He has a lot of personality and personal resilience. And, you know, people pick him up out of the street and take him home with them. He's like, you know, an adorable puppy dog. So he's had a couple of good Samaritan experiences with people taking him into their home. But because he never grew up in a family, most of his teenage years were spent in group homes, he never learned how to live with a family. And so these Good Samaritan experiences, you know, last a few months and then they collapse too. Yeah. And basically, here's a child who's rootless, without a family. The last notation in this case file, which I find unspeakably sad, is that Alfonso has no significant relationships in his life. He has no one to call upon when he's in trouble.
Well, this profile, this chapter ends with this sentence, Marilyn Dillon. This is one of his foster parents, correct?
She was actually one of the Good Samaritans.
Okay.
Yeah, she coincidentally had adopted two of his brothers when they were babies, and he didn't even know he had these brothers. And as her own adopted children became teenagers, she started thinking that it would help them to connect with their birth family. And she found out about Alfonso. He was, at that point, 17, and he was in juvenile detention because he had stolen a car. And she showed up at the juvenile detention center as he was about to be released and said, "I want to help you." I mean, it's one of these kind of fairy tale stories with, you know, he thought he was being released to homelessness. He was going to find a shelter and see what happened. And this woman took him into her home. And, you know, it had all the makings of a fairy tale ending, except that the real world doesn't work that way. You can't take a strange teenager into your home, one who has no experience living with a family, and expect it to be hunky-dory.
Yeah. Well, in these stories, there's a good deal of resilience on the part of these young people. On the other hand, it gets harder and harder. And to think that Marilyn Dillon says of this young man in his 20s, I think it's too late for him to learn to trust people and take advice.
Well, it is very hard to trust after you have been betrayed so often. I mean, from the time he was 10, he was in the custody of the state, and he had no real personal adult presence in his life. He bounced from home to home, and then as he got older, from group home to group home. His caretakers were paid caretakers who were earning abysmal wages and, you know, stayed in the jobs 3 months. And he had no long-lasting relationships. So the concept of a relationship for him meant, you know, someone he's known 2 weeks, as opposed to someone who's been there for him for the long term. Mm. And that's true of many youth aging out of care. I spent some time yesterday in Oakland with a group of youth who are in transition. They're being helped by an extraordinary organization there that helps place them in stable housing. And one after another, they talked about not being able to trust adults because so often they had been betrayed. You know, our own children, I'm the mother of three boys, 16, 19, and 22, and, you know, I can attest to how difficult it is to raise teenagers. And there are many times when we want to say to our own teenager, "That's it, you're out." But we don't. We give them another chance, and they change. Teenagers evolve, and they mature. The problem is if you're a foster child and you're a teenager, if you make a mistake in your foster home, you are out.
Yeah.
You don't get a second chance. And then you go to another foster home, make another mistake, you're out of there. And, you know, it's just a very unstable way to grow up.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the reasons, apparently, that there are so many placements. Could anything be done to reduce?
Well, I think there's a big effort being made nationally to reduce the number of placements and to attain some kind of sense of permanency for youth in foster care. There's a growing use of what are called kinship foster homes, relative placements. Because the assumption is that somebody whom you're related to is somebody you'll tolerate more easily. And I think that's a very positive trend in child welfare, that more youth are being placed in temporary homes within their extended families. Because then that way they retain their connections to their families, which, after all, are what they're going to come back to over the rest of their lifetimes.
Yeah. This was surprising to me to realize that about 20% of the children in foster care are 16 or older.
That's true. And I just checked the figures for Illinois. Actually, the latest figures in Illinois, which come from 2000, not that recent, but that showed that 15% are 16 to 18 years old. And every year in Illinois, let's see, almost 1,400 emancipate from foster care. That means they stay in foster care until the age of adulthood when their right to foster care ends. So that's 1,400 youth a year who are being sent away from the homes they have known for the last few years and told to make it on their own. Although there, you know, there are some promising things going on. This is not all bad news.
Right.
Actually, that's my message. this is a very solvable problem. 1,400 youth in Illinois is not that many youth. There is no reason that their outcomes can't be improved by directing more attention to their needs. And since 2000, when an extraordinary piece of federal legislation was passed called the Chafee Act, there has been a lot more going on in every state to help this population. Before that, there was nothing states could do with federal money to help someone after 18. They were frankly forbidden to use federal money to provide any kind of services, even counseling. And the Chafee law changed that, and now there are new programs popping up everywhere to address the needs of this group. And so I'm very hopeful, actually, that in 10 years we won't be talking about bad outcomes for this group. We will be talking about all the improvements we've seen.
Yeah. Can you give us some idea of the supports that are out there for young people as they age out of foster care?
Well, since the Chafee Act was passed, states have had the option of extending Medicaid coverage to youth after 18. And one big problem for youth aging out of foster care is that, you know, for all the time they've been in foster care, their medical needs have been taken care of, including their mental health needs, which are generally substantial after all this trauma. And then suddenly at 18, the rug is pulled out from under them. Congress gave states the option to extend Medicaid coverage, and I believe Illinois is one of the states that has. I'm not totally sure about that, and maybe a caller can clarify. But another promising thing that's happening is that states are recognizing that without special assistance, very few youth who age out of foster care will be able to go to college. So Illinois is one of the states that waives tuition at state colleges and universities for youth who have aged out of care. I mean, they have to meet the same academic requirements as other youth, but at least they don't have the tuition bill to pay.
Well, let's talk about college and how that can be a real lifeline to this age group. Let's talk about Holly Moffitt.
Yeah, well, I mean, Holly Moffitt, who grew up in very similar circumstances to Alfonso, you know, had a horrendous childhood, multiple placements in foster care. She recently graduated from college in Boston, and she was able to do that because she had support from a foster care agency long past age 18. Her agency helped her identify scholarships and grants she could get to pay for college, and then made up the difference between what was covered and what wasn't, in the same way that parents do for their children. Holly aged out of foster care in the same way that most of us make the transition from living with our families and depending on them for everything to true independence, and that is in a college dorm. I mean, that's how the typical middle-class American child makes the transition to adulthood. We don't leave home at 18 and make it on our own. We have the supportive environment of a college dorm where we get to kind of experiment with independence, but there's a safety net.
Yeah. Well, in terms of these young people, we now have this, we have a little bit of a safety net, the Chafee Act. But yet, you know, one of the things that came through to me in these stories is that, you know, we're as young people, as young adults, we're quite capable of falling down a number of times before we can really stand on our own. And the Chafee Act, the cutoff is 22.
That's right. And, you know, actually, I think one thing we can say about youth who grew up in foster care is that they tend to be late bloomers because they, you know, as I've mentioned, they are behind academically because of all of the moves they've had to make. When you change foster homes, you often have to change schools, and that's not an overnight process. You move, and your paperwork takes a month to follow you. So there are often big gaps in their high school years. They are missing credits. It takes them 5 or 6 years to get through high school. Some don't have the patience and drop out. And, you know, heading into the late teens with these educational deficits means it's going to take you longer to get through college if you manage to start college. And the support from Chafee does end at age 21. And so there's really a clock ticking once you age out of foster care. You need to really figure out what you want to do with your life and seek help while it's still available.
And then you really got to stay on track.
You have to stay on track, which is very difficult because, you know, think about what you were like when you were 18, or if any of your listeners have children in that age group, what they're like. I mean, they do make mistakes, and what keeps our own children from making fatal mistakes is that we're there to say, look, you made this terrible mistake. Let's figure out how to get you out of it. Let's make sure you don't make it again. I mean, we're there to coach them through these mistakes and make sure that they don't mean they lose their housing, they lose their scholarship, they lose their car, they lose, you know, everything that they depend on every day. There is generally no one there to help make that happen for a youth who's aged out of foster care. So a little problem becomes a catastrophe.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Journalist Martha Shirk is our guest this afternoon. Together with Gary Stengler, she is co-author of On Their Own, What Happens to Kids When They Age Out of the Foster Care System. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions and comments. I look forward to hearing what's on your mind this afternoon. You can join us in the Champaign-Urbana area by giving us a call at 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, use the toll-free number if the call would be long distance. The toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Let's talk about another story that you include in the book, the first one. The first chapter tells the story of three brothers from Brooklyn, 1 year apart in age. Lamar, the youngest, has done well, but he had some challenges with finances, with credit. Jermaine and Jeffrey, his brothers, older brothers, were in prison when they aged out. And Jermaine is dead. Jeffrey is still in prison.
Yeah, I think it's a very interesting story because it shows, on the one hand, that you don't know what the outcomes are going to be for a 10-year-old who's currently in foster care. You can't predict who is going to make it and who isn't. And so you need to assume that they're all going to make it, that they all have the potential to make it, and expose them to opportunities that will help them make it. And these three brothers came out of exactly the same circumstances, a loving mother, but one who struggled with a drug problem and with a domestic violence problem in the household. She was regularly beaten up by her boyfriend. And these three brothers were in and out of foster care through their childhood. They loved their mother, often ran away from foster care to return to her. And then at the ages of about 10, 11, and 12, they were all sent to live in a huge residential care facility called Children's Village. It's the largest children's facility in the United States. It has 450 boys living in it. And Illinois, too, relies on these large institutions to take care of teenagers in foster care, too. So these experiences would be pretty similar to what a lot of teenagers in foster care experience in Illinois. But the Williams brothers, three boys from the same background, same natural attributes, a lot of personal charm in each of them, they responded very differently to their foster care experiences. The two older ones, perhaps because they were on the cusp of adolescence, were much less amenable to what was being offered to them. They ran away from the institution. Perhaps it was because their caregivers weren't as nurturing as the ones Lamar had as the youngest boy. But the two older boys just sort of at that time were just totally hardened to any opportunities that would help them improve their outcomes. Lamar, on the other hand, kind of ate up everything that was offered to him, and he flourished in this environment. He benefited greatly during the teenage years from an exemplary program that gave him work experience and not only let him keep his earnings, but matched his earnings in a kind of IDA-like program. That's an individual development account-like program where for every dollar you save, you get another dollar from a nonprofit group as an incentive to save. And so when he turned 18, he had $5,000 in the bank. And, you know, many of our own children have the opportunity to earn money during their high school years and start to feel self-sufficient. That's an opportunity not available to most youth in foster care. But Lamar had it, and it really made a big difference in his sense of self and what he could do with his life. He also had great help in figuring out how he could go to college. I mean, here's a child who certainly had no reason to grow up expecting that he would be able to go to college. No one in his high school, in his family, had ever even graduated from high school. And he turned out to be a natural on the football field. He was able to get football scholarships and then Pell Grants and then some grants as well from his child facility. And he ended up graduating from college and getting a terrific job during the peak of the technology boom. He was earning $90,000 a year 2 years after leaving college. And this is, again, just something that we should be able to expect of anyone who is in foster care, in the custody of the state, and receiving the benefit of hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of services. We need to make sure that whatever services we're directing at them work, that they produce good outcomes rather than prison terms.
Yeah. It's very complicated, but I'm going to try and sort through this issue a little bit with you, if I might. Now, we have Lamar here who is thriving at Children's Village, and then we have his brothers that don't do so well there. How is it that placements are made? I mean, if you're in the system, you might live with a foster family. You might live with a foster family that the people are related to you. You might live in a group home. You might live in a large residential setting. How are kids funneled into these various settings?
Well, it would be nice if placements were made based on an individual child's needs, but unfortunately that's not usually the case. I've sat in state offices where the calls are coming in. We need a home for a 7-year-old boy. We need a home for 3 siblings. We need a home for 4 teenagers who are related to each other. When these calls come in, you know, one after the other, and we're not talking about we need this home in a week. We need it today because this child is in our custody. Most state and county offices don't have the luxury of matching the child's needs to the available beds. The fact is, in most cases, there isn't a bed available, and so a nice sort of warm-hearted foster mother is talked into taking yet one more child. Even though she's only licensed for 4, she opens her door to the 5th. With teenagers especially, there are very few foster families who are willing to deal with teenagers. And we all know, those of us who have teenagers, why that is. They're a very difficult population to deal with. They're just, you know, they're resistant to advice. And so most teenagers in foster care end up living in group homes or large residential facilities. And, you know, there are some very good ones out there, but it's just no way to grow up being taken care of by paid caretakers instead of somebody who cares about you. And so they develop kind of a group home mentality, and, you know, it's the survival of the fittest. You're not always sleeping next to somebody that you can trust. It's not a nurturing, therapeutic environment typically. And so they emerge from this. I think this is actually one reason why you find so many former foster youth in homeless shelters. I mean, partly it's economic. They can't afford their own housing. But partly it's that they've gotten used to group home living. They don't have a concept of living in an individual apartment on their own.
Hmm. Well, that's one of the themes of this book, you know, that foster care, we have a... How can you foster independence in a system that fosters dependence? And how can you do this with people who are at a time of life when pulling away, being rebellious, being teenagers? That's part of life. It's that we all have to do it in order to grow up. So we've got a problem there, don't we?
Yeah, it's very difficult for the system, I think, because, I mean, the system's first priority is safety. I mean, they have removed children from their parents for reasons of safety. Now, we can have a long discussion about whether they need to be removing as many children as they're removing. Most people think they don't. But if I were a child abuse investigator and, you know, I had the slightest doubt that this child would be safe in his home, I would remove that child, too. And that's why I think we have many more children going into foster care than really need to be there. But once they're there, the system creates a total dependency. I mean, they are not allowed to make any decisions about their own lives. And we know from child development studies and from our own experience with teenagers that as they get older, they need to be allowed to make decisions. I mean, how do you learn how to make a good decision unless you're able to make them? And sometimes you make the wrong ones and you learn from that wrong decision. But the foster care system controls every aspect of their lives, you know, right down to when they can go to bed. And the abrupt end of that control at the age of 18 is very difficult for most individuals to deal with. I mean, they haven't learned the baby steps they need to take to be able to make decisions on their own. And so many of them make very bad decisions. And then because there's no safety net, they end up homeless or in jail.
Yeah. Jeffrey Williams made a lot of bad decisions.
Absolutely. Yeah, and he made them before he was even 18. Yeah. I mean, he made them as a 16-year-old. And as a result, he never had the chance to age out of foster care. He was in jail. And the interesting thing about Jeffrey, though, who I've spent time with in prison, is that he's, you know, he had the same potential as his brother Lamar to be a success. He has the same outgoing personality, the same natural intelligence, the same kind of sense of being shaped by a bad family and a bad community and having overcome those issues now with a lot of introspection. And he's actually going to get out of prison next year, and I think he's going to be fine because he's grown up a great deal while he was in prison. And if somehow someone could have reached him when he was 15 and prevented him from making those mistakes, I mean, I think he and Lamar would be in business together today and both flourishing.
Hmm. We have a listener waiting to talk with us. Let's talk with our caller on line one in Champaign. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. As someone who's worked in, let's say, the child abuse, foster care, et cetera, system in various capacities, I'd like to sort of add some perspectives on it. To what your guest is saying. The first is I want to say that the first responsibility is not the foster care system, but the parents. And they're the ones who, over and over often, at least in my own experience, make the least, to say the least, bad decisions or dangerous decisions for children, whether it's in terms of their own abusive behavior towards the children, their violence, drug use, criminal behavior, and go on and on. But that's so it's the fact that the parents have abandoned their children and not seen their children as a major priority in their life for whatever reasons. I mean, we could talk about reasons, but that's a secondary factor at this point. So the primary issue is the fact that the parents of these children have all abandoned them in various ways, and most of the children are quite aware of it, even though they often are, hesitate to blame their parents and often, as you said in one case, always love their parents and want to go back. But they're also always quite cognizant of their parents' behavior and problems and the treatment of them.
I think you're absolutely right. And that's a terrible emotional burden to know that your parents didn't care enough to fix their problems and get you back.
But I think that's also we have to direct where we have to direct, attention is not only or primarily the foster care system, but the parents and the community that supports the parents in their problematic behavior. And the communities that they often live in, at least in the experience that I have, which were up and down the West Coast, the communities were very much a part of the problem. A second factor I want to bring up is the fact that my experience with the teenagers, and I worked with teenagers in a number of different capacities, both in terms of treatment, in terms of supervision, et cetera, is that there are lots of choices that the teenagers can make and do make, actually even from preteens, choices about their behavior, which gets them in and out of better or worse foster homes, or not even foster homes, but group homes, which aren't as supportive and nurturing as the individual foster homes. There's lots of leeway in the systems that I saw where the kids make decisions running away for a weekend in order to party, et cetera, et cetera. This is 13, 14, 15-year-olds, 16-year-olds, et cetera. And there's very limited consequences because both the courts, who are the primary supervisors of these children, the primary responsibility is the courts in place of the parents and local parentis, and the group homes have very limited options. So they, even when there is acting out behavior, even when there's attempts to treat it, whether psychologically, socially, supportively, etc., there's very limited options. And the foster children, so to speak, or teenagers, have major responsibility for their circumstances also. I don't, you know, it goes both ways. It's the system, it's the parents, and it's the teenagers. And I think if you don't see that, then it becomes a fix-it problem, which really doesn't get at the root cause, which has to do with the fact that, which has to do with some of the factors that I mentioned. So I'll just stop and hear what you have to say about this.
Well, I don't disagree with you at all. Teenagers make lots of bad choices, and I think teenagers in foster care are likely to make even worse choices than my teenagers have made. They haven't had good exposure to good decision-making by adults. I mean, we acknowledge that they're coming out of chaotic family situations for the most part. They are carrying around a terrible emotional burden of knowing that their family failed them and that their family has not done what is necessary to get them back and may not want to get them back. I mean, I can't tell you how many I've talked to who just, you know, feel unwanted, and that's really a hard thing to cope with. I think when you don't have much control over your daily living decisions, you're more likely to make bad behavior decisions as a way of getting attention and exerting some control. I mean, the teenage years are all about control. I can tell you that as a mother of a current 16-year-old. And the difference between a teenager in foster care who makes a bad behavior choice and my teenager who makes a bad behavior choice is that I don't say to him, you're going somewhere else. You're out of this group home. And that's what these youth face every day. They don't know if they're having a bad day and they talk back to the caregiver or worse, hit the caregiver. I mean, that's the end of their stay at that home. That's the end of the group home. That's the end of the school. That's the end of whatever relationships they made. There are catastrophic consequences for their bad behavior.
Yes, and if I could take it one step further, I think one of the solutions, I mean, it's wonderful for those who get the opportunity to go to college. Unfortunately, I've seen quite a number who wouldn't even seriously think about their independence and becoming 18, except for the fact that they would no longer be in a group home. But issues like responsibility, finances, what they're going to do with their life, etc., were the furthest from their mind, which is why I think there are options. In California, which is one of the states where I was in, there were forms of, call it similar to Conservation Corps, where people got to work in a semi-military situation in the forest, etc. And it was also a training device, which if you could make it in that sort of environment, which duplicated some of the group home and yet offered more adult responsibilities and freedoms, you could then go on from there. That and military and other settings as well as college are important venues to help them to towards adulthood.
Yeah, I'm familiar with the Civilian Conservation Corps you're talking about. I actually live in California. And the Job Corps is also a very good opportunity for many youth coming out of foster care. But I think we really, as a society, need to make sure that we don't just funnel youth aging out of foster care into extensions of foster care, which is what the Civilian Conservation Corps and the Job Corps really are. They're sort of group home environments, and they're perfect for some youth aging out of care, as is the military. But I really think we need to get most teenagers in foster care to the point where they're thinking about the same options as every other teenager is thinking about. They shouldn't continue to be, you know, a special underclass for the rest of their lives.
Well, I agree. For those that are capable in their, let's say, 15, 16, 17, they show the potential, then that opportunity should be there. Unfortunately, at least from my own experience, that was a smaller percentage, maybe 10%.
Well, it is a very small percentage who go to college right now. But I think that's partly because the foster care system didn't think of college as an option for most teenagers in its care. I mean, as I've talked about, the educational attainment levels are abysmal for this group of kids because of the many moves and the deficits actually they came into foster care with. But, you know, as I think Lamar's story shows, there's no reason to not aspire to the top while making other opportunities available for those who don't have college potential.
I agree, and if I could just close with the other opportunities need more attention because even though they're not as good as college, they're a lot better than prison or the streets.
Absolutely, and you know, our whole educational system, we're not even talking about foster kids right now. Vocational training is a totally neglected area of education these days, and the fact is that welders and plumbers and electricians often make more money than people who have gone to college and gotten liberal arts degrees. So, I mean, those kind of careers should also be offered to youth aging out of foster care.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Boy, we only have a couple of minutes left, and there's so much here left on the table to talk about. Maybe in the way of talking about a couple of other young people who you got to know, Monica Romero and Giselle John. Like Lamar, I think they saw some opportunities, and they came to the conclusion that this has got to change. I can't do this anymore. And what...
Let me talk a little bit about Monica Romero,
okay,
who is a young woman in San Antonio. And the reason I like her story is because it really shows that you shouldn't give up on a 16-year-old just because of bad behavior. And this was a girl, again, a horrendous home environment. She went into a kinship foster placement. Her grandmother became licensed as a foster parent so she could take Monica and her sisters. It was a group of four sisters. And, you know, it's very important when you enter the foster care world to keep connections with your siblings. And unfortunately, many, many children are separated from their siblings when they go into foster care. But she had the advantage of being placed with her siblings. And, you know, the caller we just were chatting with, I mean, he would have hated being Monica's foster father or caregiver in a group home because she would have challenged him at every opportunity. And she and her grandmother fought terribly. Monica ran away. She dropped out of high school. She, if you had looked at her at age 17, you would have said, this girl is heading for the streets. And the fact is that people change and they learn from their mistakes. And Monica picked herself up, went back to high school, got her high school degree, had a baby, which is often a major misstep on the road to adulthood because it makes you just way less likely to pursue higher education or get a well-paying job. But that baby gave her the motivation to do better. And I just saw Monica a couple weeks ago. She's now 22. Her daughter is flourishing. She's 4 years old. Monica has finished 2 years of college and is working in a very good $15 an hour job
while she puts herself through college. And, you know, her story to me just reiterates the importance of not giving up on youth in foster care just because they challenge you. And because, I mean, no one of it would have ever predicted that Monica could go to college. But there were people she met along the way who told her, you can do this. You want to do this, you can do this. And she found a way to do it. She got a lot of great support from community organizations. And there are programs that work and that can really help turn lives around.
Yeah,
we shouldn't be pessimistic.
Yeah, and that's one of the themes here overall, the importance of family supports and social networks. And a lot of people really believed in Monica.
And absolutely. And finally, because all of these other people believed in her, she started to believe in herself. And she would not have been able to do it on her own if she didn't have adults, caring adults and responsible adults saying to her, you can do this and I'm going to help show you how. She definitely wouldn't have made it. I mean, nobody makes it on their own. Everybody needs help along the way. And what we know from looking at this group of young people is that those who make it were actively involved in planning their own futures. They weren't just told, you're going to the Civilian Conservation Corps. They were told, here are all these options that you could pursue. Which one appeals to you? Let's think about how to make it happen. They were well prepared for daily living. They didn't come out at 18 not knowing how to open a can or put money in a bank. They were taught by doing what it takes to run a household. And finally, the most important thing, I think, is there were people along the way willing to help them, people with whom they connected. Sometimes, you know, mentor programs are great. Those that work well work wonders. But sometimes it's not just a formal mentor who makes a difference in a young person's life. It's a teacher. It's the neighbor. It's a distant aunt. It's somebody who cares and is willing to be there listening and advising and knowing when to back off and being willing to let that young person make a mistake and learn from the mistake.
There we have to leave it. Martha Shirk, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Well, thank you very much for having me on.
Martha Shirk is a journalist. Together with Gary Stengler, she is co-author of On Their Own, What Happens to Kids When They Age Out of the Foster Care System. The book is published by Westview. 7 minutes before 2 o'clock, settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thanks very much, Celeste. From the Chicago Board of Trade this afternoon, futures finished the day in the corn pit higher. The bean futures were a bit lower for the day. Let's take a look at the week's trade, though, to begin with. December corn at 204 and a quarter. On the settlement price from last week was down 0.25 cents. Fairly amazing given the 11.6 billion bushel crop that USDA released on Tuesday morning that was able to hold on that well. In the bean pit, the November contract was off a nickel from last week. Last week's settlement price on Friday afternoon, 5.19 in the no beans. Today it was 5.14. Now, let's take a look at the day's trade. December wheat futures at the Board of Trade, 3.19 and a half. The high, the low at 3.14 and a half. A settlement price there at 3.19 and a quarter. They finished the day 5 and a quarter higher. That's 5 and 1 quarter higher in the Dease wheat. March contracted the board for the soft red winter wheat, 3.31. The high, the low at 3.25 and a half. A settlement price there at 3.30 and 3 quarters, up 6 cents. And the May futures, 3.35. The high, the low at 3.30 and a half, settled 3.34. They were up 5 and a half cents. July contracted nickel higher at the end of the day. Traded at 337 to the high, the low at 331, and a settlement price for the harvest month at 336 and a quarter in the wheat pit, up a nickel for the July. December corn futures, 207 and a half, the high, the low at 204 and a quarter, settled on that low at 204 and a quarter. They still finished the day 2 and 3 quarters higher. The March futures, 217, the high, the low at 214, settled 214 and a half. They were up 2 and a quarter at the end of the day. May futures by the end of the trading day today, 224 on the high, the low at 221, settled 221 and a half. They were up 2 cents. And July corn at 231 high, low at 228. Settlement price there at 228 and three quarters, up 1 and 3 quarters. September futures, 237 and a quarter the high, the low at 234 and a quarter. Settlement price at 234. They are rather 235 for the September corn for next year. That was up 2 cents. And December next year up 2 as well. 246 the high, the low at 43, and a settlement price at 44. December oats now, 146 the high, the low at 143 and a half, settled at 45 even. They are up 1 and 1 quarter. March futures up 1 and a half, 152 and a half the high, the low at 150.5 settlement price. For the March oats at the Board of Trade, $1.52. November soybeans now, 518 the high, the low at 513, settlement price 514. They were a penny and a half lower at the end of the day's trade. January futures 523.5 high, low at 518, settled on this Friday afternoon at 518.75, down 2.5. And the March futures 529.5 the high, the low at 524.5, a settlement price 525.5, down 2.25. And the May contract off 1.25 today, 536 the high, the low at 531. Settled 532.5. Once again, that May futures in the bean pit, a penny and a quarter lower. July contract, 542.5, the high, the low at 537.5. Settlement price at 538.5, down 1.25. And the August soybeans, a 542 high, the low in the settlement price for the August beans, down 2 cents at 540. December bean meal, 153.80, the high, the low at 152.10. Settlement price there at 152.70. They were up 20. And the January, 154.80 high, low at 153.40, settled 153.90. They were off a dime. December bean oil, 20.64 the high, the low at $20.30 a pound, settled 20.32. They were down 18. And the January were off 20 at 20.47 at the end of this trading day. Now here's Celeste Quinn with the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange.
Okay, Todd, it looks like everything finished higher today at the Mercantile Exchange as far as the livestock contracts that we cover here on AM 580. Let's begin with feeder cattle. October feeders, 114.20 the high, 113.95 the low, 114.12.5 the settlement, that unchanged. November, 112.75 the high, 112.22.5 the low, 112.37.5 the settlement, that up 17.5. January, 109.05 the high, 108.55 the low, 108.92.5 the settlement, that up 7.5. October live cattle, 87.05 the high, 86.20 the low, 86.92.5 the settlement, that up 67.5. December, 88.80 the high, 87.92.5 the low, 88.75 the settlement, that up 65. Lean hogs finished limit up today. December, February, April, and May. December lean hogs, 66.85 the high, 65 even the low, 66.85 the settlement, that up $2. February, 66.87.5 the high and the settlement, the low, 64.92.5, that up $2. April lean hogs, 64.85 the high, 62.85 the low, finishing at today's high of 64.85, that up the limit. May, 65.40 the high, 63.35 the low, 65.40 the settlement, that up $2, up the limit. February bellies, 96.60 the high, the low, 93.30 the settlement, 96.52.5, that up close to the limit, $2.92.5. And now let's turn our attention to the Dow. It is currently up 52 points at 99.46, the NASDAQ up 11 at 19.14, the S&P 500 up 6 at 11.09.
The Carl Center for Rural Health and Farm Safety is proud to underwrite agricultural programming on W.